I love a good mystery, and so does everyone else. In fact, everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey.
I know that our listeners will absolutely love this game because you are uncovering the mystery of June's sister's murder, and you're becoming a detective. You're looking for clues, and each scene will lead you to a new thrilling storyline.
This is a great way to engage your observation skills to uncover key pieces of information that lead you on to many chapters of mystery, danger, and romance. Right now, I'm in the process of interviewing family members, and this is bringing me back, just so you know, to my days in law enforcement, and I'm having such a blast with it because it is so much more lighthearted, but it also has the mystery of where will this take me?
You can even chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. You'll even get the chance to play in a detective league to put your skills to the test. Megan, I think we should join a detective club together. We've got this.
Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast features criminologists discussing sensitive themes and topics. Listener discretion is advised.
A teenage girl is shot in the face on her ride home from school. But because of her tenacity for life, she would go on to become the youngest recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. This is the Malala Yousafzai story. Morning, Megan.
Good morning.
How's it going today?
It's going. It's about all I can say about
all
today.
Right. Well, we have a great episode because we are doing something special. Actually, for this whole month, we'll be doing something a little special here. So today, in honor of International Women's Day, which is in just a few days on March 8th, we wanted to bring you a case that highlights a woman of international importance. Now, Megan, this took me a long time because there is no shortage of amazing women. In fact, that's why this whole month we're going to devote to Women's History Month.
That's right.
So today's episode, an international hero, so to speak, and then the next episodes of this month will all cover a woman who has had some sort of lasting impact on our criminal justice system. And I really hope that these cases will inspire our listeners as much as they have inspired us.
Well said, Amy.
And, you know, we've done other cases in the past that highlight amazing women and also amazing women outside of the U.S. And one that comes to mind, at least that I've covered, was Karuna Nundi, which was back in episode 87. She was a human rights advocate and a lawyer who fought for gender equality, among other things. So inspiring women, just like Karuna and today's subject, Malala, we don't talk about them enough. We spend a lot of time trying to understand women who have been victims or offenders. So it's really nice to pivot a bit and, you know, put a different focus on these episodes for this month.
I agree.
But I have to tell you, I was attracted to this story, not only because of her incredible work that she has achieved at such a young age, but also because of her resilience and bravery in the face of violence.
I mean, your opening kind of said it all in that regard. So yeah.
Yeah, so you have an idea of what we're getting to here. But I have to tell you, Megan, this is the longest episode I've ever written. It's also the most sources I have ever used in any episode. And I have to tell you, I feel like I'm just scratching the surface of Malala's life and her global impact.
Okay, well, I'm ready.
All right then, Megan, let's go ahead and meet Malala. Malala was born on July 12, 1997 in Magora, Pakistan. And this is the largest city in the Swat district of the country. She was born into a lower middle class family, and the family consisted of her mother, her father, and her two younger brothers. This tight-knit family was part of what's known as the Pashtuns. They are a tribe of people who are spread across Afghanistan and Pakistan, and in Pakistan, they make up almost 20% of the population and are the second largest ethnic group in Pakistan. An interesting fact, historically, Pashtuns bore the name of Afghan before that name came to denote any native of the land of Afghanistan. Now, the Pashtun culture is widely recognized for its code of conduct called Pashtunwali, which emphasizes hospitality, honor, and forgiveness. In addition, the Pashtuns have a rich literary tradition and they have their own language. So that's a bit on their ethnicity. Malala's parents were both from a mountain village, but they had relocated to Mingora after they had met. Her mother, Tor Pakay, was the carer for the home and the children. And this is customary in their culture, where we see less than 25% of women join the labor force. And this is due to several factors. A huge one would be limited job opportunities, but for some, it's also the cultural and social norms that prevent them from working outside of the home. Now, Malala's father, Zayuddin, he was a very hard worker outside of the home. In 1994, he founded a chain of private schools known as the Kushal Public Schools. He was also a poet and an educational activist. He was very involved in political matters, and at a very young age, Malala realized that she wanted to follow in her father's footsteps. The two were very close and spent a lot of time together. And the Yousafzai house was always filled with family and friends. In fact, in Malala's memoir, which I'll talk a lot about today, she explains how the women would often gather separate from the men when they would get together. She says the women would talk about cooking or clothes and that the men would discuss politics. And she said from a very young age, she preferred the men's conversation. And it was really nice that her father encouraged her because not a lot of men in that culture maybe would have encouraged a young daughter to be a part of a conversation that was typically usually male. So the two, he always included her in what was going on. And at some point, she decided she wanted to tag along with her father when he went to work.
That's very sweet.
Yeah, and his work was really interesting because he essentially did everything for his school. It's not that he was just a principal, Megan. He was a principal, a teacher. He was the school's accountant, the janitor, and the handyman.
Wow.
Yeah, but he still made barely enough to support the family, regardless of doing all this hard work. Now, because of the environment she was in daily, Malala quickly began loving learning and just the school environment in general. She also excelled in her studies, always earning the highest grades in her class. Malala and her father would spend hours discussing political issues, and although Malala had always wanted to be a doctor, she saw herself as an educational activist and soon had her sights set on politics as well. And at just 11 years old, she began giving talks at a local organization called the Peshawar Press Club. Essentially, how I understand it, this was an organization of journalists and media professionals where they would go and exchange ideas. It was like an open forum for learning.
What an awesome thing to have at a young age, too.
11 years old, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, this was great for Malala, but it was a bit on the dangerous side based on what was going on in her hometown at this time. You see, at this time, the Pakistani Taliban militants were taking over the Swat Valley. They were banning television, music, girls' education, and even women from going out of the home. But despite this danger, it did not stop Malala from being honest about her feelings at one of the press club meetings, where she said in one of her speeches, quote, "How dare the Taliban take away my basic right to education?" And this speech would then go on to be covered by newspapers and local TV. And I just want to reiterate how dangerous this was.
Yeah.
Because especially women. And actually, she wasn't even a woman. She was just a young girl at this time. So it was very rare to have someone of her age and gender speaking out like this.
Right.
But Malala was a force to be reckoned with, as a year later, in 2009, at just 12 years old, she began training in a youth group called the Open Minds Pakistan, which was hosted at the Institute for War and Peace Reportings. Now, what they did was they worked in region schools to help students engage in constructive discussion on social issues through journalism, public debate, and dialogue. So this group would identify and nurture young, promising, potential youth leaders. And that's clearly what Malala was on the path for.
Oh, sure. Yes.
And after a very short time, Malala was promoted through the institute to the position of peer educator, where she herself would be teaching other students some of these ideals and principles.
Accomplished young lady.
Oh, Megan, we're not even getting started yet.
Right.
And not long after this honor, she would be presented with yet another opportunity. Her father, Zayuddin, was approached by a BBC journalist who was covering Taliban's growing influence in Swat. The journalist was looking for something very specific. He wanted a schoolgirl to be able to blog about the conditions and what was going on in the area. So he had approached Zayuddin, who headed this school, to say, "Can you please find me a student who might be interested or willing to participate in such an activity?" And the editor who was running this piece remarked, quote, "We had been covering the violence and politics in Swat in detail, but we didn't know much about how ordinary people lived under the Taliban. So this was what his task was. But unfortunately, he found that no student would do it because there was a very potential danger of this situation. Now, although the blog was going to be done anonymously, it wasn't worth it to a lot of these children, especially girls in the area.
I really understand. I mean, you have to balance safety, and I get it completely.
Yeah, but he ended up volunteering his own daughter, Malala, because Malala wanted to do it. She was in only seventh grade at the time, and this is a bit younger than what the journalist was looking for, but it would do. And as you could probably guess by now, she was very wise beyond her years, and she would actually be a perfect fit for this job.
Listen, I applaud her and her father, but I will say as a parent also, my instinct would tell me to be concerned about her safety a bit as well. So I don't know how that played into their decision.
I'm glad you brought that up because I didn't talk too much about Malala's mother because, you know, her and her father are kind of at the center of the story at this point. But Malala's mother was very worried, but she was also very supportive. And she knew that speaking up was necessary if they wanted things to get better for girls and women in their area.
Sure.
So for her protection, Malala was giving a pseudonym. And I guess this maybe helped ease her mother's fears a little, but it sounds like this family is just blazing a trail here. She wanted to do this, and her parents were just, you know, standing behind her.
Much to her credit, a brave young girl.
Yes. On January 3rd, 2009, her first blog post was published. It was titled, I Am Afraid, and she wrote about the launch of the military operation and the effect that it had on her school. She shared the fact that many girls stopped going to school altogether out of fear of what the Taliban would do. She also described how difficult it was at home as well, because she couldn't sleep at night with the constant fighting going on outside of her home.
Right.
And she said she feared leaving her house, especially when she left her house to go to school. And over the 2 months that she wrote this blog, the situation would become much more severe, as on January 15th, 2009, the Pakistani Taliban set a strict rule now that no girls could attend school at all in Swat. And Megan, this was after they'd already blown up more than 100 girls' schools, and those that were still standing closed their door to girls altogether. And even some schools that were just for boys temporarily closed as well, just because there was so much going on. Malala documented all of this in her blog, and excerpts from her explanations of the awful situation were published in a local newspaper in addition to the blog. And while the blog was anonymous, at least for now, Malala was publicly speaking out against the Pakistani Taliban on a national current affairs show, and she wasn't afraid to show her face and express her discontent with what was going on. She said she was proud to be speaking out for girls' education and that she didn't feel the need to hide her identity. And Megan, it wasn't just local. At this point, because of the internet, the whole world could see what was going on in Swat. About a month later, the Pakistani Taliban did lift restrictions on girls' primary education when there was co-education. So you had your girls-only schools that were still closed, but some girls were now slowly returning to co-ed schools. But many were fearful and many did not return at all. But as you can probably guess, Malala was not one of those young girls. She did return to school.
Yes.
And weeks later, the ban was fully lifted after a peace deal was signed, and the girls were now allowed to go back to school, but they had to follow strict rules. One of the main rules was that they would now have to wear burqas. Now, burqas are garments that covers the body and the face with only a small area. Usually it's like a netted area for the eyes. Mm-hmm. And in many instances, as I understand it, a woman will often choose to wear this type of garment to express modesty or cultural views. But there are also times, such as this example, when they are forced to by law.
Yes.
Although there was still a lot of unrest in the area, such as people being displaced, there was looting going on all around her. Malala was back in school and her life somewhat resembled normal, at least for the circumstance. But then in May, what was known as the Second Battle of Swat took place. And now things escalated further and things got bad for Malala and her family. They got displaced and separated. Her father went to protest and lobby while the rest of the family went to stay with family in the mountain regions. Malala explains this time in detail in her memoir, and it's really heartbreaking. They had to leave everything behind, and they didn't know what would happen next. They had no idea how long they would be gone or if they would ever be returning, and they weren't with their father, so this was a very stressful time.
Sorry, Amy, I know that you said this, but how many siblings, how many children were in the family?
She has two younger brothers.
Okay.
They ended up returning a few months later to what they said felt like a war zone. Now, people were told that the Taliban had left, but there was a ton of fear and destruction all around because nobody knew if and when they would return. As always, Malala was very inspired by her father's activism, and she wanted to be even more like him than ever. By December of 2009, about a year after writing her blog, Malala's true identity as the, quote, blogger was revealed, and she was now working on a documentary with the New York Times titled He Named Me Malala, and she also began making more frequent TV appearances to publicly advocate for female education. She would also attend rallies and events with her father, who was still her biggest supporter. Now, for this documentary, a camera crew followed Malala around as she went to school. And she's, you know, straight up told them, quote, "They cannot stop me. I will get my education. This is our request to the world. Save our schools, save our Pakistan, save our SWAT." And while the war may have been over, there were still many attacks by the Taliban. And usually these attacks targeted people who spoke out against them.
Right.
And they also continued to target and destroy schools. But Malala forged forward. By 2011, at the age of 14, she began training with a local girls empowerment organization called Aware Girls. They do a training that includes advice on women's rights and empowerment to peacefully oppose radicalization through education. And then that same year, she was nominated for the International Children's Peace Prize of the Dutch International Advocacy Kids Group, Kids Rights Foundation. They're basically a global movement for children's rights. And get this, Megan, she had been nominated by Archbishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa. And I'm sure many of our listeners know this name because he played a crucial role in the fight against apartheid, and he was a hero of Malala and her father and many others around the world as well. He is one of the most inspiring men. You should actually go on and read about him as well. He led nonviolent protests, and he was pretty much known as the voice of the voiceless for Black South Africans. And she was the first Pakistani girl ever to be nominated for this award. And the announcement said, quote, "Malala dared to stand up for herself and other girls and use national and international media to let the world know that girls should also have the right to go to school." That same year, she was also awarded Pakistan's first National Youth Peace Prize and was given the National Peace Award for Youth by the Prime Minister.
Wow. She's accomplished a lot more at age 15 than I've accomplished in my 40s. Okay.
Megan, this is nothing. We're barely scratching the surface here. But
wow.
But the great thing about her, and you could see this when she speaks and in her interview, she's not just getting these awards. She's also asking for things. So when she was given the award by the Prime Minister, she asked the Prime Minister, "Can you rebuild the schools that have been destroyed?" And she also asked that the government establish a girls' university in SWAT. So she was using her platform to get things done.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And after this, the Prime Minister directed authorities to set up an IT campus in the SWAT degree college for women at her request. And then a secondary school was named in her honor. And get this, I forgot as I'm going through this, I'm forgetting just how many accolades there are here. The annual prize that she received from that point forward was called Malala's Prize.
Well, they named it after her.
They named it after her. And by 2012, this wasn't enough for her. She was now planning to organize the Malala Education Foundation, which would help poor girls go to school. And a lot more on that foundation in a little bit. And all the while, she was still publicly fighting, telling one news station, quote, "I am not afraid of anyone. I will continue to get my education." But Malala had a lot to fear, and rightly so, as the more recognizable she became, the more of a target she became for the Taliban. She had received several death threats on her social media accounts, and some threats were sent to the actual media. And it didn't stop there, as a Pakistani Taliban spokesperson said that because of Malala's outspoken behavior, they were, quote, "forced to act now." Now, this is a real threat. I don't think it gets much more real.
I mean, it seems like a credible threat.
And I think as any father would, Malala's father was thinking it was time that they stop their advocacy work, at least for the time being. He thought it was just too dangerous. And while he was okay with risking his own life for the causes he believed in, his daughter was now in danger. And as a father, that's where the line was drawn for him.
Sure.
But Malala's response to his urging was, quote, "Everyone knows they will die someday. No one can stop death." And she further told him, "You are the one who said if we believe in something greater, then our voices will only multiply, even if we are dead. We can't stop now."
Wow. Too wise for her parents.
I know. And Megan, they didn't stop. Although they were now living in constant fear and may have changed a bit about how they went about their everyday life, they continue to advocate for what they believed in. On October 9th, 2012, quote, "a day like any other," as Malala calls it, Malala rode home on her school bus with about 20 of her peers. Now, this ride was typical until a man stopped the bus, and then another man, a masked man, got on the bus with a firearm and shouted, "Which one of you is Malala?
Yeah.
Speak up, otherwise I will shoot you all."
Wow.
Upon being identified, Malala was shot with one bullet point blank in the head. Now, this bullet traveled 18 inches from the side of her left eye through her neck and landed in her shoulder. Megan, she was just 15 years old.
Did they shoot anyone else or did anyone else get hurt during the shooting?
So that's a good question because it was very clear to bystanders that those men were there for one person and that person being Malala.
Yes.
However, two other young girls were wounded during the attack as well, but they would go on to make a full recovery.
Like intentionally? Did they harm her intentionally or was it an accident? Like they were bystanders who were, got in the way. I don't know.
Yeah, it's not clear, but from what I understand, these other girls were not targeted. And I would bet that they just got injured as, you know, from being around from the gunfire. Because I would imagine there was more than one bullet that was shot at Malala at this time.
Okay.
Now, these girls would go on to make a full recovery. Malala, on the other hand, was in critical condition. Some would even say grave condition.
Yeah.
As she was airlifted to a local hospital. She had emergency surgery to reduce the swelling in her brain and to also remove the bullet, which was lodged in her shoulder, but very close to her spinal cord. She also had to undergo what's called a decompressive craniotomy, in which part of her skull was removed to allow room for swelling.
Mm-hmm.
And although she survived surgery, she was in pretty bad shape.
It's a miracle that she survived a gunshot to the head already.
It really
just
is.
Just saying.
Now, on October 15th, a couple of days later, once she was stable enough to travel, she was transported to a hospital in Birmingham, England, where she would be able to receive better treatment for her injuries. This hospital was called the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, and one of their specialties at this hospital was the treatment of military personnel who were injured in conflict.
Okay.
The Pakistani government publicly stated that they would be covering all of the costs incurred by the family, including medical, transport, and needed accommodations. Malala awoke from her medically induced coma 2 days after being airlifted to the UK. And she was very confused when she awoke. She was unable to talk. She was barely able to see, barely able to hear. She was in excruciating pain and surrounded by tons of doctors and nurses. She had no idea what happened to her.
Was her family with her at the time? And did the doctors have any prognosis at this time?
Yeah, so this was really tough for Malala's family because her family wouldn't be able to get there for 11 days because they needed to get the proper travel documentation for her brothers to leave the country.
Right, okay.
Malala's mother did not want to leave the brothers. Actually, Malala's mother could not leave the brothers. And
right.
Malala's father felt that he needed to stay to protect his wife and his other two children because Malala was in really good hands at this point. No one knew the exact prognosis because, again, she wasn't able to walk. She wasn't able to talk, see, hear, you know, so they knew she was alive.
They didn't know at this point if these things would come back or.
No,
okay.
They didn't really know because she also had a lot of surgeries ahead of her as well.
Okay.
I mean, as the days passed, they did start to tell her what happened. So she was awake for a while. She was using one of those pads when you can't speak to, like, you know, spell out stuff. But the doctors and nurses would tell her that, you know, she was an absolute miracle. It was not expected that she would survive such an attack. It was shocking as she was getting better day by day, slowly starting to heal. Slowly, her eyesight returned, her hearing was improving, and she regained her ability to talk. But Megan, while she was doing better, she had several infections. She had kidney and lung failure and also had to go intensive surgery to repair facial nerves. And then there was all of the rehab exercises. She needed to learn how to use her arms and legs again. She needed to regain the ability to smile and wink because there was a lot of damage to the nerves in her face. While recovering in the hospital, UN Special Envoy for Global Education, Gordon Brown, who was the former British Prime Minister, visited Malala and subsequently launched a petition in her name and in support of, quote, what Malala fought for. Using the slogan, quote, "I am Malala," the petition demanded that there be no child left out of school by 2015 with the hope that, quote, girls like Malala everywhere will soon be going to school. Now, the plan was to present the petition to the UN president with the following demands. First, they were demanding that Pakistan would agree to a plan to deliver education for every child. They were also petitioning that all countries would outlaw discrimination against girls And lastly, that all international organizations would ensure the world's 61 million out-of-school children were in education by the end of 2015.
Very ambitious.
This horrific attack was bringing much-needed attention to this global issue that hadn't really been getting center stage. Meanwhile, on January 3rd, 2013, Malala was finally released to start outpatient rehab.
Wow.
She still had a lot of surgeries, Megan, though.
Yeah.
Due to her intensive recovery, Malala and her family now resided in Birmingham, England, and they would be there for the foreseeable future. Besides the fact that she was doing all this recovery, it wasn't safe for them to be returning to Pakistan anyway.
I was going to point that out, that this is probably the safest place for their family at the time.
And, you know, the living arrangements were very comfortable. They were enjoying a lot of freedom. They had a gorgeous home. You could see it in this documentary. But they really missed back home in Pakistan, especially her mother, who didn't speak fluent English. So it was difficult for her to get acclimated.
Oh, sure.
And remember, her father had to give up his school to stay in England. But he didn't give up his advocacy work because he was still advocating for education. He would attend conferences and speak out for peace. And he also ended up getting a position working as an advisor for global education at the UN.
Wow. That kind of activism, the way you describe it, it's ingrained in who you are. I could see him having to give up a school, but you're not able to give up that part of who you are, I would say.
Yeah, and he certainly didn't. And the family seemed to be settling in to their new life. And her two younger brothers were also both attending school.
Right.
And, you know, they were all doing as well as could be, given what they were up against. And while the family was settling into their new life, the murder attempt on Malala was receiving worldwide media coverage. People were angry and protests erupted in several Pakistani cities. And over 2 million people signed the Right to Education campaign's petition, which led to the first Right to Education bill in Pakistan, which said, quote, "The state shall provide free and compulsory education to all children aged 5 to 16. Officials also offered a 10 million rupee, which is a little over $100,000 US dollars, reward for information leading to the arrest of the attackers. A lot of people were concerned about their safety, but Malala's father publicly said, "We have an ideology that advocates peace. The Taliban cannot stop all independent voices through the force of bullets." The attack was considered not just on Malala, but as an attack on civilized people. And many leaders in other countries, including then President Obama, made public statements about the heinous acts. And as we often see, many famous people came forward to show support for Malala and to denounce the Taliban. Madonna dedicated her song Human Nature to Malala at a concert in Los Angeles the day of the attack. Madonna also supposedly got a tattoo that was temporary in Malala's honor. Angelina Jolie wrote an article about the event and later donated $200,000 to a fund for girls' education in Pakistan. Former First Lady Laura Bush, who wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post in which she compared Malala to Holocaust diarist Anne Frank. Selena Gomez tweeted about the situation. Beyonce wished her well in a Facebook post. Point being that there was a lot of worldwide attention. And usually we'll see after this type of attention, there's some demand for action. And it wasn't long before a chief spokesman for the Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. Although everyone knew, it was clear who did this anyway. I don't think there was any question. You know, everyone knew that she was being targeted by the Taliban, but they claimed responsibility, saying, quote, that Malala is the symbol of the infidels and obscenity, adding that if she survived, the group would target her again. They explained that they had enlisted two local men to collect information on Malala's route to school, and then they had carried out the attack again that they were, quote, forced to. The Taliban also placed blame on Malala's father, saying, quote, "We warned him several times to stop his daughter from using dirty language against us, but he didn't listen and forced us to take this extreme step." They also justified their attack as part of religious scripture, stating that the Quran says, quote, "People propagating against Islam and Islamic forces would be killed. Even a child can be killed." But Malala rejected this. And as she stated in her memoir, quote, "Truth will always triumph over falsehood. That is the true Islamic belief that has guided us on our journey. The Taliban shot me to try and silence me. Instead, the whole world was listening to my message now."
Yeah, that's a very fair point, right? They wanted to silence her, but all they did was give her the biggest platform they could.
Yes, and I like how she made sure to respond to, you know, because they're reading the same religious scripture, but they're both interpreting it very different. So, you know, I love that she made a note that, like, well, that's not actually what it's saying. This is what it's saying.
Well, the Taliban was using religion to justify, you know, their means or their goals, their beliefs. You know, it sounds like Malala's interpretation is probably the truer read of that.
Yeah.
And not just the Taliban, we see other radical groups use religion, weaponize religion, and interpret it very differently to further their goals.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so now that someone's come forward and gone public with the responsibility for Malala's shooting, was there any apprehension, punishment? How did they deal with this development?
In 2015, a Pakistani anti-terrorism court sent 10 men to prison for 25-year terms. Now, this was a closed hearing, so there wasn't much public information on it that I could find. However, what was shocking to many was that most of these men were later released due to lack of evidence. The media would report it as a secret acquittal, though there are many sources that say 8 of the 10 men were never formally charged, so it's not entirely true that it was an acquittal, because you can't have an acquittal if you weren't charged.
Right.
So what I can tell you is that there ended up being just 2 men who were held responsible. But in response to the idea that there was 10 and then only 2 went forward, there was one report I read that said in this area and in South Asia in general, that it was, quote, common for police to respond to public pressure by arresting large numbers of people who turn out to be unrelated to the crime in question, including relatives of suspects. So perhaps this explains it, given that there was so much media attention and so much pressure, they brought in all 10 men and then realized it was only the 2 of them.
And the 2 that they identified, did they spend the 25-year term or close to it in prison?
Good question. They were actually handed life sentences. One man's identity is unknown. The other man has an identity that is very well known. His name was Eshanullah Ashan, who was the former spokesperson who took responsibility for Malala's attack. Now, this man also claimed responsibility for the Peshawar Army School terror attack in 2014, in which 132 students were killed. So most of the public was pleased with this man being behind bars. Now, Megan, I know we've been talking a bit, and I guess most of our episodes would end around this time, but this is where the story actually starts. Because although many people would have likely retreated after something so traumatic, Malala was ignited.
That doesn't surprise me one bit here.
Now, let's start with the fact that just 6 months after her release from hospital, she addressed the United Nations. On July 12, 2013, the day of her 16th birthday, Malala stood in front of the UN and called for worldwide access to education. In this speech, she said, quote, "The terrorists thought that they would change my aims and stop my ambitions, but nothing changed in my life except this. Weakness, fear, and hopelessness died. Strength, power, and courage was born. I am not against anyone. Neither am I here to speak in terms of personal revenge against the Taliban or any other terrorist group. I'm here to speak up for the rights of education for every child. I want education for the sons and daughters of the Taliban and all terrorists and extremists." The UN would go on to dub this event Malala Day. And this was just the beginning for Malala, because after this, she traveled to Buckingham Palace, where she met with the Queen. Then she spoke at Harvard before visiting with President Obama. Then she addressed the Oxford Union, which is a prestigious debating society in the city of Oxford, whose membership is mostly drawn from the University of Oxford,
right,
but they have a reputation for bringing in international guests and speakers. She then went to the Girls Summit in London, which was a global meeting hosted by the UK government that was aimed at mobilizing domestic and international efforts for children and women. And throughout all of these meetings, Malala called on world leaders everywhere to invest in, quote, books, not bullets. And just a year later, on October 10th, 2014, Malala was announced as the co-recipient of the 2014 Nobel Peace Prize for her struggle against the suppression of children and young people and for the right of all children to education. Malala shared the prize with Kailash Sarathy, a children's rights activist from India who campaigned against child labor and right to education. The Nobel judges praised both of these individuals for their, quote, struggle against the suppression of children and young people and for the right of all children to education. At the age of 17, Malala was the youngest Nobel Peace Prize winner and also only the second Pakistani to receive the prize. And while doing all of this, Malala also published a memoir in 2014.
Wow.
And this was one of my main sources for this episode. I devoured this book in 2 days, and I'm making my daughter Jordan read it.
Is this how you found the case, Amy? Because I know you love memoirs.
No, I wanted to do this case because I had heard of it, and then I ordered the memoir before I started writing the case.
Got it. Great.
But you are right. A lot of times I do find my cases that way.
I know.
So this memoir is called I Am Malala, the story of a girl who stood up for education and was shot by the Taliban. And this was co-written with British journalist Christina Lamb. The memoir, not surprisingly, had gone on to win several awards. That same year, she was named as one of Time Magazine's 25 most influential teens of 2014. I can't sit here and list all of her accolades, and there are many, many more, but I think you get the gist. I do urge our listeners to go ahead and look these up, though, because she has done, it's incredible to think how much she has done. And you would think after the Nobel Peace Prize, maybe she'd slow down a bit, but she's not, you know, not Malala. In July of 2015, at just 18 years old, she opened up a school in Bekaa Valley, Lebanon. This was near the Syrian border, and she opened the school for Syrian refugees. The school was to be funded by the nonprofit Malala Fund and offer education and training to girls aged 14 to 18 years.
Amy, did she and her family remain in England?
Yep, they remained in England. She would visit, though.
Okay.
She would go back to Pakistan to visit, though.
Sure.
She also did a lot of work there, actually. The Malala Fund that I just spoke about, with that fund, they also started a project in Swat for girls who were suffering from domestic child labor.
Got it.
And this was to help them become independent and attend school.
Okay.
And according to the Malala Fund website, the organization has invested more than $47 million in total across its various programs.
Incredible.
And she also continued to write. In October of 2017, she published a children's book about her life called Malala's Magic Pencil. Then her second book for adults was released in 2018 called We Are Displaced, My Journey and Stories from Refugee Girls Around the World. So this book explores not only Malala's story, but also the stories of girls that she met from her travels to refugee camps in Colombia, Guatemala, Syria, and Yemen. This book is on its way. I already ordered it.
Of course.
And then in January of 2018, Apple announced that it was partnering with the Malala Fund to help provide education to more than 100,000 girls around the world. The company pledged to contribute money and technology, as well as assist with curriculum and policy research. And while doing all of this writing and advocacy work, she was also continuing her education. In 2020, Malala graduated from Oxford University with a Bachelor of Arts degree in philosophy, politics, and economics. Malala got married on November 9th, 2021, to a man named Asr Malik, who she met while she was at Oxford. I don't know too much about him, but he too studied philosophy, politics, and economics, and he works for the cricket's governing body in Pakistan and is the co-founder of a cricket amateur league.
Oh, okay.
Isn't that cool? Actually, her family, Malala's family, are very avid cricket players.
I did not know that. I like that fun fact.
See, there's so much information. I can't possibly get it all in this episode.
No.
In a recent interview, Malala stated that her relationship with Asr has helped her see that she could, quote, remain true to my values of equality, fairness, and integrity while simultaneously being in a relationship. She goes on, I still don't have all of the answers for the challenges facing women, but I believe that I can enjoy friendship, love, and equality in marriage.
That's beautiful. Really is.
In October of 2022, Malala published yet another children's book about her life called My Name is Malala. And recently, in April of 2023, Malala announced that she is working on a new memoir. You know I will be keeping my eyes out for this book.
Oh, yes.
Today, Malala continues to be a force for good in women and children's educational rights. And so what happened to the man responsible for trying to kill her? He escaped from what's known as an army jail in 2020, and this had come to light after an alleged audio clip was released by the former Taliban spokesperson that confirmed his escape.
Wow.
I don't have more info on his whereabouts or the other man, whether he was released or whether he also fled. Remember, there were two men who were held responsible.
Yeah.
That other name was never publicly released. So it's hard to know his whereabouts. Yeah, I would hope he was still be incarcerated.
I mean, if we didn't hear anything else, I would assume that he remained incarcerated. But so the main perpetrator, was this the one who went public? So he escaped and he has not been apprehended to date.
Yes. And he is the one who has a lot of other, who committed other very heinous crimes as well.
Right. Oh, well, that's terrible.
Yeah. So usually when we wrap up, we talk about our theories or did the system get it right. So I think today's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to highlight or underscore just how incredible this young woman is. And the story is all the more amazing because of just how ruthless and lawless the Taliban is. And I did a little research, you know, to really understand what she was up against.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to give you a little bit of a history lesson here, okay?
Okay.
The Taliban is an ultra-conservative political and religious faction that emerged in Afghanistan in the 1990s. This was following the withdrawal of Soviet troops, the collapse of Afghanistan's communist regime, and the subsequent breakdown in civil order. Now, the Taliban perpetrated egregious acts of violence against women, including rape, abduction, and forced marriage. And things got so bad that some families sent their daughters to other countries for a safe haven. The Taliban ruled three-fourths of Afghanistan from 1996 to 2001 before being overthrown following the American invasion. And that's when many say they regrouped across the border in Pakistan. Now, the Taliban unfortunately returned to power in Afghanistan in 2021 and have since cracked down on women's rights and human rights in general, and there has been overall an economic downturn since. Instead of focusing on what theories can help us understand why Malala was intact, I want to take a moment to just talk about what criminological theories tell us about understanding terrorism.
Okay.
I don't know about you, Megan, but I have not done a lot of work on terrorism in terms of criminological theories. But from my understanding, rational choice theory, social learning theory, and subcultural theory seem to be the primary theories that can explain why people are involved in terroristic acts.
Exactly.
Participation often stems from a perceived injustice, need for identity, or the need for belonging. I'm wondering if there's anything else in your studies that you've come across.
No, I would have focused primarily on culture clash as well. That's what I perceived as well in this case because of the two cultural differences and because of the loyalties to one's culture becoming so strong. And I think that's social learning. So learning theory is really, to me, micro level mm-hmm. cultural theory in that, you know, you're learning from individuals, but culture clash or cultural theories are like culture is your teacher. Mm-hmm. So they go hand in hand. One is individual learning and one's kind of culture as the teacher. So those are primarily the theories with terrorism, along with rational choice. Mm-hmm. Especially in the planning out of terroristic acts.
Yeah, Megan, you mentioned rational choice as a way to explain why people carry out terrorist activities. Rational choice is this idea that people do things based on free will. They weigh the pain and the pleasure, and they will always choose the option that is designed to bring them the most pleasure and the least amount of pain.
Yeah, ultimately, when you're looking at rational choice, there's probably two parts of it. And one is that people in these such extreme situations will choose their allegiance to their cause as superior, and that outweighs any discomforts or any pains, even if it comes to their own death, their sacrifice. Yep. The allegiance to the cause is their kind of higher power, mm-hmm. higher cause, and that's the choice that they ultimately make. So rational choice is about a choice, but new rational choice theory is also about the series of decisions that goes into the choice. And so with terroristic acts in particular, there's a lot of planning. So I think rational choice also goes into the many different choices and steps that are involved in the planning. As you mentioned in Malala's case, the terrorists had to track her schedule down. They had to follow her. They had to get intel. They had to plan an attack. So it's not only one choice, but a series of choices made to then carry out the crime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this might be one of the first times in how many years have we been doing the show, Megan? Five?
Going into our fifth.
We're going into our fifth year. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we've talked about terrorism in terms of criminological theories, have we?
I can't recall.
Yeah. Well, because overwhelmingly, you'll see many terrorist acts are carried out by men. But of course, there are many female victims.
Yes.
But, you know, maybe moving forward, we can explore this area a little more because I definitely have a lot to learn in this area.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about you, Amy, but I've only taken one or two courses on terrorism, like at the master's level. Mm-hmm. And I was definitely out of my own depths, but felt like there was so much I did learn a lot from those mm-hmm. courses and could learn a lot more.
I don't think I've ever taken a class on terrorism, to be honest.
Well, never too late.
I guess not. Okay. Maybe one of my next lecturers will. I'll teach it to myself so that I could then teach it on
right?
one of our supporter
right?
lectures.
There you go.
All right. Well, speaking of our supporters and listeners, I know how much everyone loves getting involved and supporting some of the work we talk about. So before we close out today, I want to tell our listeners how they can get involved if they choose to. You've heard me mention the Malala Fund. The Malala Fund was actually founded by Malala and her father, Zayuddin, and they run the organization together. And they are working towards a world where every girl can learn and lead. And you could find their organization at malala.org. And this fund invests in education. The advocates and activists who work for the Malala Fund are challenging the policies and practices that prevent girls from going to school in different communities. The organization works in regions where most girls miss out on secondary education. And the Malala Fund does everything from supporting STEM education for young women in Pakistan to creating safe learning spaces for girls in northern Nigeria and a lot more. And Megan, I think that we should help the boys too. So I wanted to just give another organization that's called SaveTheChildren.org. Save the Children was the first global movement for children. They've worked in over 100 countries helping children become healthier, safer, and better educated. The work they do is so incredible, Megan. I fell down quite the rabbit hole when looking at their website. And if you're going to peruse their website, I would suggest bringing a box of tissues along because, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm dead inside, but I have to say I was shedding a few tears looking at this website. If you're interested, then go to the Ways to Help tab on SaveTheChildren.org, and you can also learn more about what they're doing or donate if you so choose to. Megan, I hope that this episode was a good example of a woman who should be recognized for International Women's Day, would you say?
I think you couldn't have picked a better story. She's very, very inspiring.
Yeah, for a minute I was thinking, should I reach out to her for an interview? And then I was thinking, I think she's probably pretty busy. And then I had imposter syndrome and I was like, there's no
way. Oh, stop it. She probably is busy, but you could have reached out. Who wouldn't want to talk to you, Amy?
Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much, Megan. Thank you so much for joining us today. And as always, we will catch you next time on Women in Crime.
Women in Crime is written and hosted by Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg. Our producer is James Varga. Script editing is by Abigail Bel Castro. Audio editing is by Siler Burr and Jose Alfonso. And music is by Dessert Media. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and leave a review. You can also support the show through Patreon, where you can get access to additional ad-free content such as exclusive full-length episodes, lectures, a book club, and virtual happy hours with Megan and Amy. For more information, visit patreon.com/womenandcrime.
Sources for today's episode include I Am Malala, How One Girl Stood Up for Education and Changed the World, BBC News, New York Times, Reuters, Democracy Now!, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, National Geographic, The Express Tribune, British Vogue, Biography.com, Time, Huffington Post, The New Yorker, The Christian Science Monitor, The Daily Telegraph, UN News Service, CNN, The Nation, NPR, ABD.org, and the film He Named Me Malala.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.